Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Revolution Watch podcast. As usual, I'm Kevin, your host, and joining me is Stephanie.
Hi guys, thanks for tuning in again. Later on in the episode, our guest is Sylvia Earl, who is a marine biologist and Rolex testimony. She speaks with Darren, our editor-in-chief of Asia and Australia, on Mission Blue, which is her latest project. So stay tuned and don't go anywhere.
But first, let's talk about the news. So something happened quite recently that was big in the watch industry is the change of name for SIHH.
Yep, so SIHH, as we know it, is no more. Last week, they announced that it will be rebranded as Watches and Wonders Geneva for 2020. The name should sound quite familiar to a lot of people because the show has made an appearance in Hong Kong and also in Miami.
Yeah. Watches and Wonders in the Hong Kong edition actually was the first proper watch fair that I went to. Was it the same for you or no?
I think so, yeah. I went to Watches and Wonders in Hong Kong before I went to Basel and SIHH.
Right. So this is the first time we actually get to, you know, see the brands, enter the booth, see the watches, touch them, talk to people. So that was quite cool.
Yeah, so I think maybe we can go and look at the press release and see what it says.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, so it says, for its 30th edition in April 2020 in Geneva, Salon International de la Haute Horlogerie makes the biggest change in its history. With a new format, new name, new dates, and a new audience, SIHH becomes Watches and Wonders Geneva, an unprecedented concept now in association with the city and the canton of Geneva.
Okay. What are the new dates again for the Watches and Wonders Geneva?
So I think they changed it to start a little bit earlier than they first announced. So the new dates are from April 25th to April 29th.
All right. Cool. Well, that's right before the Basel World, is it?
Yeah. So it's still concurrent, like one will happen after the other.
Okay. Well, that's cool. So the new format secures some approval from some of the watch brands, according from what the press release is saying. We can see, for example, that Cartier, Hermès, Ulysse Nardin, they all approve. Max Busser from MBNF seems to agree as well that this is a good move and should open up, you know, the fair to a wider audience.
Yep, actually, it's not too much of a surprise because if you look at the last two or three editions of SIHH, you could already see that they were starting to change the format of the show and bring in the public. There's like the public day on the last day of the show.
Yep.
So it didn't necessarily feel like a trade fair already. And I think it's natural for FHH to continue to evolve the SIHH to cater to, you know, the new developments and its end users.
Right. But so as we've seen it from previous years, so the salon as we know it is still kind of going to be there. They're just expanding the kind of public aspect to be more interactive and more connected to the consumer, is it?
Yeah. So there also is the lab, which they started this year, 2019. Mm-hmm. It was quite successful. So they're bringing that one back. It's a space where the latest technology and watchmaking innovations are showcased. So there are new apps that, you know, FHH are using, also like news of Vacheron Constantin digitizing its archives, you know, things like that. There's another platform called Live, which is being added, but for now it's a bit vague about on what it actually means. It says it will offer, you know, world-class access to international product launches and exclusive announcements, and keynote speakers, things like that, but who knows what it is because they didn't announce anything more than that.
But as a platform during the fair or something like extra on the side?
I think during the fair. So I think it will still be around the salon.
Okay.
Well. So it might be because this year and I think last year as well, there has always been discussions and panels that happen at the same time as all the other watch presentations and things that are happening. So it might be that but expanded a bit more.
Oh, okay. Well, that should be interesting starting from next year. We'll see how that goes. So the most exciting part actually that I found is that Geneva, the city, is becoming part of the experience, right? The FHH is calling it in the city. So, you know, we can expect, I'm guessing, public exhibitions, walking tour, which, you know, I mean, with Geneva being kind of like the mecca for watchmaking, kind of makes sense that the city is involved in some way.
So watchmaking workshops, manufacturer visits, you know.
Right. Museum open houses, probably, you know, boutique openings for the public. So that should be very interesting, actually. Yeah.
Do you think this is a good idea, like rebranding it to Watches and Wonders in Geneva?
Well, I mean, like the name itself, sure, because, you know, SIHA, like if you say it to a lot of people, like, it doesn't
mean boring.
Well, it doesn't mean a lot of things also, right? If you say Watches and Wonders, it's going to, you know, it's a bit more attractive to even someone who doesn't know much about watches.
Yeah, right? The wonders of watchmaking sort of thing.
Right, because the thing is that SIHA, like if you look at all the words, they're all French, right? Whereas here, at least Watches and Wonders, it becomes a more international name that can reflect, I guess, the wider customer base of, you know, watchmaking as a whole.
Yeah, and I think it can be quite attractive to collectors and enthusiasts as well, because, you know, they're also visiting the city, the canton of Geneva, walking around and, you know, like being in the country, like, you know, being outside rather than just inside the fair.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. I mean, you know, Geneva itself is not a bad city to, you know, walk around. So if you start putting watch-related aspects for, you know, collectors and enthusiasts, and it should be fairly interesting.
Yeah. But I can feel like for some brands, it might be quite a sudden change, or like there is suddenly so much more to plan before the show, and it could become a hassle. But we'll have to probably speak to the brands to see what they actually think of all the new changes.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk to them, and then if we have any more updates from them, we'll come back in another episode and we'll keep you guys updated.
Okay, so that was a longer introduction and news section than usual, but this week we do have a guest on the episode. Sylvia Earle is a marine biologist and explorer, and also a Rolex testimony, who has been studying the sea and the marine life for 50 years.
Yeah, so she spoke to Darren Ho, our editor-in-chief for Asia and Australia, on her latest and most ambitious project called Mission Blue. Her mission identifies hope spots in the oceans that need caring for and preservation. So without further ado, let's get into the interview.
Before we start, I just wanted to ask you one question that I have been quite curious about. I understand that you have two nicknames.
At least.
One is her deepness. The other one is Sturgeon General.
Yes.
Can you tell us how that nickname came about?
The Sturgeon General, when I was chief scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. I think because I kept asking questions about the policies regarding fisheries that seemed all about dead fish, and I keep insisting that there's a value to fish alive that we are not properly accounting for. So that's when I got the title, you know, Sturgeon General. I said the fish alive in the ocean have a zero accounting base. It's only when they're dead that they have a price tag. And I thought that was really not properly accounting for nature.
Now, you've been very, very involved, particularly with the establishment of Mission Blue, on accounting for living creatures in the sea. Tell us about the hope spots. Now, I know you've told us why the name hope spots, but how do you pick them?
Initially, when the concept got underway in 2010, I won the TED Prize and was asked to make a wish. My wish was to ignite public support using media, the internet, films, new submersibles, exploration. But the goal is to inspire the creation of places in the ocean called hope spots, large enough to save and restore the blue heart of the planet, the ocean. Right now, we can see the evidence in my lifetime of dramatic changes. We've managed to deplete on the order of 90% of many of the fish and other ocean wild species, from squid to tunas. We've reversed course with respect to whales. We used to just take them for barrels of meat, pounds of oil, but now we see other values. We used to take birds primarily as something to eat, wild birds, but we've changed direction on that. Maybe there's an opportunity in our lifetime to respect ocean wildlife in ways beyond just how good they taste. We've seen, I have been a witness to a loss of half the coral reefs, half the seagrass meadows and mangroves around the world. There have been consequences to these, to this loss, in terms of economics, in terms of the degradation of the systems that keep us alive. It's not just about the fish and the whales and krill in Antarctica. It's about, in the end, the impact on human civilization. I'm a human. I have children. I have grandchildren. And I look not just at my own personal concerns, but just at the value of all the things that humans do care about. Where have we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? And if we fail to take care of the systems that keep us alive, nothing else matters.
Now, how does Mission Blue work with the local community at these hot spots to help to ensure that protected, preserved,
Yes. Initially, we, a group of people who came together around the idea, just made some selections of places that seem so obvious, like the Great Barrier Reef, like the Galapagos Islands, the Patagonian Shelf, the little island nation of Palau and the surrounding islands and waters. And so we actually launched at the same time that the ocean in Google Earth launched in 2010, and we helped make that happen too, with National Geographic, created a little film embedded in the ocean in Google Earth that celebrated that first handful of hope spots. But since then, we've developed a relationship with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, IUCN. They have a network of volunteer scientists, and we have a little group of individuals who review applications that people, champions from around the world, who say, we have identified a place that is important, and we'd like to nominate it as a hope spot.
Okay.
And there's a process now for individuals, for communities, for institutions to say, we care about this place, here's why we think it's important, and here's the commitment that we are going to make to take it from where it is, to protect it or to restore it, and to become a part of this network of hope. And Rolex has stepped up and has been helping us with communication, helping to build a framework that makes it possible for people to share their stories, to put their images, their photographs, data, so that we can eventually, and we now have 123 places that this committee with IUCN has reviewed and approved and offered advice and help to communities and hope spot champions all over the world. And we're rapidly growing and expanding that number. It's become a bit overwhelming because people do care and they are responding. So we're trying our best to scale up and to be able to respond effectively to this wondrous outpouring of care. The idea is really to, through getting people to understand and take action personally and at a community level, at a country level where it's possible, but wherever, to give people a voice, to give the ocean a voice, to celebrate whatever others are doing as well. We're not trying to create yet another layer of bureaucracy, but rather to create a vision of hope and empower people to do what they can to get official designation through their governments for full protection. That's the goal of areas as much as possible, to work with other organizations. We have more than 200 partner organizations. We celebrate what they're doing, celebrate their success and their stories, because that's how we will succeed, is by working together to build this collaboration of hope.
You're incredibly optimistic about the possibility of reducing or reversing the impact that man has made on the global environment. What gives you this optimism?
Because I've seen it work. There are more whales today than when I was a child. There are more sea turtles today than when I was a child. Why? Because people have been motivated to see sea turtles, to see whales differently, and to respect coral reefs for more than just something beautiful or something useful, because they protect us from storms and all of that. There's an intrinsic sense of it's the right thing to do, to respect life, whether it's a tree or a turtle or a lobster, that we have an opportunity to look at ourselves as a part of the living world.
Okay.
Because we couldn't see when I was a child what's now children of today can see. That's cause for hope. It's the power of knowing, the superpower that everybody on the earth today has as compared to those who lived 1,000 years ago or even 100 years ago, even 10 years ago. We keep learning at a fast rate, and that's critically important, because it's understanding that Earth is not infinite in its capacity to support our wishes, but it certainly can support our needs if we are able to respect what the limits are.
Now, there's one marine protected area in Singapore that's actually seen an increase in diversity ever since it was established.
Yes.
Are you looking at developing more hope spots within Singapore and the region?
We certainly are working with the people of Singapore, inviting their desires, if they wish to submit to become a hope spot, the door is open. We'd love to embrace the good news that's already happening with a park that already exists, and to, again, celebrate the good things that are happening here. We're working with the universities, working with the Earth Observation or Observatory. I mean, there's so much here in this country that inspires hope.
Now, we know that establishing MPAs does incredibly improve biodiversity within the marine ecosystems, but this takes time. In Mexico, I think it took about 10 or 20 years before fish populations started to bloom. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's enough courage within our communities to ensure that and maintain?
The key is understanding the value back to you personally, you, your family, your city, your country. And you can quantify it. The economics are there, especially if you are honest about accounting for nature. Do you like to breathe? It's not free. I mean, we can, and we are undermining the capacity of the planet to maintain Earth in a way that is fundamentally vital for us. Once we understand that our choices will determine whether we succeed or not as a species within the natural world that keeps us alive, and we couldn't see it 50 years ago, when we thought the ocean was too big to fail. We can now see that the ocean is failing, and it's because of us, but it's because of us that we can heal the harm and move in a positive direction. This is a moment in time that could not exist before because we just did not know. We made decisions based in ignorance. The ocean used to be thought of as the best place to put trash. We know that there is a cost to using the ocean as a dump site. It's coming back to haunt us with not just the unsightly nature of beaches covered with plastic debris, but in the creatures that we consume from the sea that themselves have consumed the plastic that gets back to us and all the toxins we're putting into the ocean. Not necessarily because of what we eat from the ocean, although that is a real issue, but affecting the chemistry of the ocean affects the oxygen production, the carbon capture. It's a climate issue. What we're taking from the ocean, what we're doing to poison the ocean, does ultimately come around to the carbon cycle, to the production of oxygen, to maintaining a planet that works. We can see it now. We couldn't see it before, but not everybody does see it. So our job, my job, everyone who does understand, to make it known to the extent that we can, to inspire people to go see for themselves.
Now, that brings me to my next topic, which is geoengineering. There's been a lot of talk about this, whether it's about figuring out solutions, man-made solutions, basically, to try to reduce our reduce the impact of, say, global warming, to what we can do, whether it's from trapping carbon in limestone, etc., stuff like that. Do you think this is a real viable solution? Do you think we should be exploring this, or is that really a very, very last option that man should be looking at, trying to change the environment in order for us to maintain our lifestyle?
Our highest priority needs to be to protect what remains of the natural systems that have taken 4.5 billion years to create, that we are unraveling in 4.5 decades. Number one, protect the wild. With the high seas, it's half the world that is still in better shape than most parts of the planet. But clear cutting of the ocean wildlife is taking place, industrial scale extraction of tuna and other fish that are in the high seas. That, for the economic reasons, for environmental reasons, for ethical reasons, we need to put a stop to the extraction on an industrial scale by a handful of nations affecting all people everywhere. We have a chance to restrain the destruction for the public good, for the future of humankind. That's the heart of the heart of the ocean, the engine that drives climate and weather, that shapes planetary chemistry. We have an obligation to take care of it. It's a global commons. And to have a few vested interests taking from what all of us have a share in, if you will, as the global commons. No country owns the high seas. So everybody benefits if we take care of it. Only a few in the short term benefit by extracting from it. So let's it's like protecting your heart, protecting the systems that keep us alive. The other big thing, though, and it's been a dual track in my life, protection for sure, but we need to explore the ocean below where we now can go conveniently. Divers, I mean, there are now millions of divers. Everyone, like an astronaut who goes up in the sky, comes back and says, I want to share what I have seen. Divers come back and say, I want you to see what I've seen. And that's been very helpful. But we can only go, you know, like 50 meters into the sea as air-breathing scuba divers. You can go deeper with special mixes of gases, but still, 300, 400 meters, but the ocean is well beyond that, and that's where most of life on Earth is. It's where most of the action is, and it's where the ignorance is the greatest. So I've been really working with engineers for much of my life, too. I've had thousands of hours underwater. I've lived underwater 10 times. I've had the long view. I've had the gift of time. I've used more than 30 different submarines. I want everyone to see what it's like at 1,000 feet, in deep in the sea where it's dark. And I'm really hoping that here in Singapore, there might be a base for little submersibles that can take not just lucky scientists or those who are working for industry or for the military, but teachers and scientists, of course. But why not children? Why not the heads of corporations? Why not moms and dads? Why not government officials? Why not anybody, everyone, to have the gift of time underwater? Be able to go at 1,000 feet and just sit there, and the way you can go sit in the forest, the way Jane Goodall has spent time getting to know the animals that she's caused us to know and love. If we could go down and see a giant squid, maybe we'd feel differently about calamari.
You're absolutely right. And it's also, it's a powerful way of getting the unconvinced and those who don't believe to show them that this is what we're really doing to the world.
Right. Even seeing a fish in its own world and see how fish relate to other fish. There's a community down there. There's a closely knit interactions of life. And when you just look at something on your plate, you just don't understand what it has taken to make these creatures, how they actually live, what they do.
Let's talk about Rolex and Mission Blue. What are your plans for the next few years? How is Rolex helping Mission Blue? What do you want to achieve with Rolex? What do you want Mission Blue to get to?
Communication is a very large part of the mission of Mission Blue, to inspire people to do what they can individually by knowing what the issues are, and of course to inspire them to care in with the individual choices they make, but to grow this network of hope and to go deep within the hope spots and to develop and use the technology that will enable exploring beyond the sunlit surface. But let's see what it's like in the deep sea. That's where most of the action is. So every hope spot has deep water associated with it beyond where divers can go, but it's presently mostly unknown. So part of the spirit of exploration with Rolex is just that. Let's go find out what's going on, who lives there, and how does it relate to the rest of the world. So fostering expeditions is a key part of what Mission Blue does and what Rolex is assisting with. It's developing the community support around the world for protection, but it's also supporting exploration and communication. It's a very big idea, but there's a very big need to do just that.
All right. Overfishing, as you mentioned, especially the overfishing of wild species, is something that has become a very, very critical issue within the ocean conservation community. Developing aquaculture is something that many of them have mentioned and discussed. What do you think we need to do here?
There's a place for smart aquaculture. I see a lot of not very smart aquaculture underway. It is unwise to raise carnivores. We don't raise carnivorous animals to eat on the land. Cows eat grass, chickens, pigs, goats, sheep. It makes sense. Of the thousands of mammals, we've chosen those that grow fast, taste good, nutritious, and that They lend themselves to cultivation. In Asian countries, carp have been raised for thousands of years in ponds, freshwater. They grow fast, they eat plants, and they can taste like whatever it is you want to season them with. Lemon or garlic or onion or whatever. They can be very versatile. And tilapia is similarly very versatile and very nutritious. And they eat plants. And they can be grown in relatively small areas. And the idea of closed systems, I think, has the greatest hope, because you can control the light, the food, and systems that include a plant and animal component, which I've seen in action, where tilapia or catfish or carp are grown in a pond, and the water that they add nutrients to through their consumption, they fertilize the water that then in turn helps the neighboring gardens to grow. And the gardens extract the nutrients, fresh water goes back into the pond, or if it's a closed system, then you can very efficiently get a lot of sustenance out of a small area, a small amount of water, and you can watch it carefully to make sure that it's clean. And you don't have to add pesticides or other agents that are so a cause of concern on the large-scale farming that is now taking place, industrial farming. I think that scaling more to local use and consumption, reduce the transportation costs, having the ability within communities and areas to eat more locally, and also to focus on plants. There's nothing in our biology that requires that we have to eat animals. We are perfectly capable of feeding the whole world just on plants, and it can be and must be, should be, delicious. Be creative about how we prepare the many wonderful variations on the theme of plants, and to grow them effectively and efficiently. For those who choose to eat animals, we should choose to eat animals that eat plants, and look at and increasingly just let the wild birds, wild fish, wild animals. I mean, there are some cases where people don't have many choices, where taking from the wild is vital to their survival. And I think that needs to be respected. But I think we need to look at the large industrial extraction for products as well as for luxury choices, not needs, that we need to seriously look at and reduce, eliminate where we can, because that's affecting the chemistry of the ocean. There's a big carbon cost. It's a cost we aren't paying for in full, and it's subsidized by countries around the world. It'd be a big economic break if we just think differently about industrial-scale fishing.
Okay. I have two more questions for you, very, very quick, but they are not on the sheet. It's just your opinion and your take on things that I wanted to get. The first one is this. Do you think that people have who react or refuse to acknowledge that humanity has responsibility for climate change?
No question. I just look at the evidence.
But it's not about that. Exactly. But do you think that they react in a way they do because they don't like the term responsibility, because it makes them feel like they're at fault and therefore they need to be punished, or they should be punished in some way for it, or they feel that this is their punishment?
It's not a matter of punishment. You know, if you don't know, and we did not know until now, I think that now that we know, it's foolish not to protect yourself. It's not a matter of
There's a lot of refusal punishment by a lot of people to simply
that's a weird way of thinking. Yeah. Because it's like, now we know. This is a gift, the gift of knowing. I didn't understand. Now I understand.
And I can do something.
And I will never, because it's in my best interest. It's not that you're not at fault if you don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
But now we know. There's no excuse anymore.
Okay, the second question is this. You were the first female chief scientist at NYA. In the science, and even in watchmaking luxury, right, it's traditionally been a very, very male society. As someone who was really a representative of female empowerment, do you think there's still a long way to go for equality between the sexes today?
Well, there's no question that men and women are different. I'm a biologist. I've observed this. It's obvious. And those differences are to be celebrated. But in terms of opportunity to be the best you can be at whatever it is you're good at, we have to acknowledge that there is a discrepancy now. And whether it's equal pay for equal performance, we need to address that. But to bring out the best in whatever it is you have as a gift, everybody has something they can do that is unique to them. Everybody. I cannot sing. I wish I could. I have maybe a way with animals, with nature. As a scientist, I have an enhanced sense of curiosity. And whatever an individual, male or female, has, you can
nurture those skills.
You can make excuses. You can say, I'm too tall, or I'm too short, or I'm a girl, or I'm a boy. I'm various shades of color, and therefore I can't. Or you shrug your shoulders and say, I'm going to do what I can, the best I can, with who I am, and get on with it. Get on with it. And I think many of the problems we have faced as women are in our own minds, that we can...
Because you fought very, very hard to be...
I never thought of it as being fighting. I was just doing what I love the best I could, and to have a sense of humor. But the main thing is to treat others the way you would wish to be treated. So my male colleagues, I do not expect favors. I treat them the way I would like to be treated. I carry my own bags. If somebody wants to help me, okay, but I don't expect them to, because I'm a woman, to go out of their way to help me. I do what I can to just be... not just with other people, but I think if I have a way with fish or whales or grasshoppers, it's to treat them with dignity and respect. Dignity and respect across the whole gamut, of the whole spectrum of life, but particularly my own species, whether it's a child or a CEO or a fisherman, or anybody, everybody, just everybody is worthy of being treated that way.
So, can you believe Sylvia Earle is 83 years old?
I did not know that she was 83 years old, no.
So, she's 83 and still working so hard to conserve her oceans. I think it's incredible. And
still diving.
Yeah.
That's dope.
Yeah,
I think that's dope.
Yeah, so the kind of testimonies that Rolex has. And that's all we have for you this week. We hope you enjoyed the show.
As always, please make sure to leave us a comment and a rating wherever you get your podcasts. And we hope you tune in for the next one.
Yep, and leave us a comment to let us know what you'd like to hear next. Bye.
See ya.